Welcome to the Fearless Women Podcast. We're inspiring conversations for the unafraid. I'm Janice McDonald, founder of the Beacon Agency, author, and global champion for women. Why am I making this show? Because I want to share the inspiring stories of women leaders in business, arts and culture, politics, and more with all of you. Hear how they've chosen to go forward and be bold and make the world a better place, even when it wasn't easy to do. Subscribe now wherever you find podcasts. Hey, everybody, I'm Janice McDonald. Welcome to the Fearless Women Podcast. I'm very excited to welcome Helen Hirsch Spence to the show today. She's the founder and CEO of Top 60 Over 60. So we're going to have a lot to talk about around entrepreneurship, ageism, and so much more. Welcome, Helen.
Thank you, Janice. It's great to be here.
And welcome to our listeners from around the world, including UK, USA, Ireland, Hong Kong, France, and so many more countries. We want our community to grow, so please tell your friends and follow us on Instagram. Thanks also to our amazing sponsors, 30% Club Canada, ADGA, and BDC. So after a long career as an educator, you saw the opportunity to start Top 60 Over 60. Helen, tell us about this organization and your plans to encourage entrepreneurship in older Canadians.
That's an interesting question because it didn't come automatically at all. It was probably a result of frustrations that I often felt after I turned 60 and was confronted with ageism full force. I knew exactly what everybody else had been talking about. I had heard so much about top 40 under 40, top 30 under 30, and so on. I thought it would be wonderful to start an organization called the Top 60 Over 60, to inform people that, in fact, you can be older than 30 and 40, start something new, and be successful. And that was really the origin or the genesis of the idea of the Top 60 Over 60. And I've had opportunities to research and get involved in many different aspects of aging, working with employers, working with individuals and groups. So the underlying theme is, you know, eradicating, reducing ageism, but the way in which we are doing it now has to do with working with businesses and organizations to help them unlock the potential of all of their employees, but especially some of their older ones, and to help them transform that multi-generational workforce into a productive intergenerational team. So that really is all about intergenerational collaboration.
Which is exciting. And I know that you're familiar with so much of the current research around not only ageism, but the fastest growing segment is older entrepreneurs.
Yeah. So entrepreneurship is definitely one component of it. So the Top 60 gives people an opportunity to dispel myths about ageism from many different angles, from the individual side to those interested in reinventing themselves as entrepreneurs, but also perhaps reinventing themselves and going into a new area. However, as I say, what we're really focusing on at the moment is helping business, corporations understand fully the biases that they have in their hiring, in retaining staff and in letting them go and not necessarily rehiring them at a time when we have a shortage of skilled labor and we also have the largest cohort of individuals over the age of 65. And we will continue to have that large cohort for at least the next 3 decades. So if we don't attend to that longevity bonus that people are living at the moment, helping those individuals to find work that is satisfying or at least helps them financially maintain themselves, we're going to have a serious economic problem. So therefore, it's about prosperity as well for the country, for individuals, for society, for our healthcare system. Because when you stay involved, when you're engaged, you stay healthier. Mm-hmm. And there's tons of research to prove that.
Mm-hmm.
So there's a multi-focus.
Yeah, I can see the benefits, obviously, and getting this right for Canada is so important when we think about how many people we're talking about. And there's so many jobs that are open. And when we think about also the future of work and where things are going.
Yeah.
This huge resource that really needs to be tapped into.
Yeah, it's an untapped resource. And in fact, it's a bias against our future selves when you think about it. Those who are in hiring positions who don't ever think they're going to get old, which is typical of those of us who are at one time under the age of 40. It's damaging. It's damaging to society as a whole. And I think slowly we're coming around to that realization that old is no longer the grandma in the rocking chair knitting and grandpa smoking his pipe on their porch. In fact, there are very few people that I know that have fully retired now after the age of 60, 65. They are looking for their next step, their next act, their encore career, whatever you want to call it. And sometimes it's entrepreneurship.
Mm-hmm.
Not always.
And, not always.
And
no.
It doesn't have to be either.
Mm-hmm. So you've had a very long career also as an educator. And so here you are as part of the cohort that's rewiring, I guess,
mm-hmm.
right?
It's
doing
that's
new
right.
things, which is exciting. And of course, you had this opportunity to start Top 60 Over 60 and really taking us into all kinds of new direction. So let's talk a little bit about this time that you spent your career as an educator. So you spent time both in the public and private schools. You certainly went on to be head of a prestigious all-girls school.
Going back, the origin of my career was not intended. My father wanted me to take education courses, and there was no way I was going to do that. I'm of the generation that as a woman, you could be a secretary, a nurse, or a teacher, and I had no intention of being any of those things. So the rebel in me left home after university and went to Germany. And when I found myself in Germany, I was unable to find any work other than as a teacher, teaching English and French. And so I fell into it that way. And I loved it when I was there.
So maybe Dad knew something after all.
Yeah, he knew a lot. I think he knew better than I knew myself what perhaps I would have been good at. In any case, so I went on to teach several years in Germany. And from there, I immigrated to Canada. And when I got here, I was with somebody at the time who had his papers all in order, and I really couldn't stay legally in this country, so I decided to become a student, and then I would be legal. Again, this is early 70s, so most people who are listening to this probably weren't even alive. So the immigration procedures were different back then. So I went to the Formation des Enseignants here in Ottawa because I wanted to teach secondary level, and it was the only place I could do it in Ottawa, which is the French component of the University of Ottawa. And I got my degree and immediately found a job teaching immersion French and German in one of the Ottawa public high schools. And so I kept on going.
Yeah.
And I was a teacher for many years, had children, and decided after not too long that I didn't want to do this forever. So I found all different ways of using the teaching expertise that I had to do consulting within the board, department head, became a vice principal when there weren't that many female principals. In fact, there were maybe two or three ahead of me, and they referred to my high school as High Heel High. Mm-hmm. And I was proud of that. I know that that's not what was intended, but it was an interesting time because, I mean, there had always been four administrators who were men. Suddenly, if they were a majority women, you know, there
that
were comments
different.
And we were
mm-hmm.
under scrutiny all the time.
Mm-hmm.
But it was a successful team and we did well, and it was a wonderful experience. So education for me was always about maximizing the potential of the students and the staff. And so there was a natural progression after I retired and had done 10 years of volunteer work in a variety of areas. I realized that what I really wanted to do was help out another generation, which was my own, and helping them sort of restart, repurpose their lives in meaningful ways so that they could benefit from their next 30 or 40 years.
Yeah. So when you think about even how people were taught is so different over the generations, what kind of an impact does that have when you're thinking about multi-generations in the workplace?
So it's interesting. In terms of the way in which people learn, I think that today and even 10, 15, 20 years ago, there was an awareness about different learning styles. So that was vastly different from what I was exposed to as both a student and as an early teacher. You know, it was all about regurgitating facts and repeating what you had learned from the teacher. It wasn't about original thinking. It wasn't about creative or critical thinking to the same extent as it was to have gotten the material right. So there was a real focus on knowledge, comprehension, but there wasn't very much emphasis at all on, you know, evaluating the thoughts or synthesizing ideas and so on. And over time, it's been very apparent, as early as the 80s, in fact, I was able to participate in a wonderful initiative that Bernice McCarthy had started called FORMAT. And what it was all about was acknowledging the four different learning styles and teaching to the four different learning styles. And that was actually a pivotal point in my career, because I realized to what an extent some of my students in the past probably had been disadvantaged, because I probably also was not as aware as I might have been that the kinesthetic learner as a child would have to learn letters by drawing in the sand. And there were similar things in secondary school. And that generations of children have missed out on opportunities to learn as best as they could. So it isn't about just teaching to a learning style. It's teaching in all different learning styles.
And everybody, which are the four R?
The four R, essentially, they have to do with analytical thinking, kinesthetic, audio, mm-hmm. and conceptual or experimental. So you have sort of different questions mm-hmm. that they always ask themselves. There are some children that always ask themselves why, and they need to know why first.
Why is my favorite word in the whole dictionary?
Yeah, yeah. Mine too, and I get into trouble for asking as many questions as I do, because I always ask why. But you can have a combination, and you have strengths in all of them, but there's one or two in which you have strengths. And that ties in very much with some of the psychometric work that I've been doing in terms of thinking and behavioral preferences too. It's very aligned with that. But as I say, having understood as well as I finally did when I was exposed to this, how important it was to access every different learning style in a lesson, I was able to carry that over with all the consulting and the strategic work and the retreats that I did and consulting and so on. And it certainly has helped me be more effective in everything that I've undertaken that has anything to do with teaching or coaching or, you know, guiding, facilitating, always thinking of those principles that I learned at that point. And moving forward in time, now we have all the technology that we definitely didn't have, you know, before the 2005 or so. So it wasn't as big an issue. But I can see now just the expectation of parents for teachers to be communicating with them all the time is an additional expectation that is extremely challenging, because parents, generally speaking today, always are defending their children and looking at the individual as opposed to the collective. And I believe that that's one of the things that has changed dramatically, is that whole individualistic approach that many parents today, and even parents back in the 80s and 90s may have had, but there wasn't as much opportunity to demonstrate that they really cared mostly about their own child, and sometimes to the detriment of the entire class. So I see that as being something that's very different. It can also be something very positive, I might add, not just negative. So there are a lot of innovations that I think need to be rethought, and many of them that just need to be, you know, added on to the ways in which we have always done things. I am not an advocate of going backwards at all. I think that mostly what we are learning and able to do today is to the benefit of young children. And it's just very different. So I'm trying not to be at all judgmental, but to listen.
Well, I remember going to a session that you did where you talked about preparing students today for jobs that don't exist in companies that don't right. exist, and the speed of change yeah. and how that's a lot of pressure, both yeah. on the students, but also on educators to be able to, and workplaces, because right. you've got different. So it's a fascinating time for sure, which is why I think the work that you're doing with Top 60 Over 60 is so relevant.
Yeah, thank you. I agree. And change is exponentially accelerating. I mean, recently I heard something that, you know, nothing really changed from 1900 to 1950, and then it doubled between 1950 and 1973. And then between 1973 and 1990, it doubled again. And we're up to now annually doubling the amount of information that we have to work with. It's really hard.
Mm-hmm. And then you add in, are we getting good information?
Yeah, of course.
I mean, it's part of that.
Media
that's a
literacy.
Separate
yeah, financial literacy. Yeah, that's mm-hmm. another. That's mm-hmm. another. So there's lots to learn. But I think the emphasis is moving away from, I know it's moving away from just regurgitating facts and more to analyzing and evaluating what you're hearing and being a lot more creative. Because face it, innovation today is critical. Mm-hmm. And that's not necessarily something that we used to emphasize mm-hmm. in school.
Yeah, unlocking that creativity to solve problems.
Yeah.
Which is so exciting when diverse groups come together,
exactly.
right? And there's lots of research that proves that
Absolutely.
Already.
Absolutely, yeah.
So, okay, Helen, what's the last thing you've done that's really scared you?
Well, we talked about it a bit already. I was very interested over a long period of time in social entrepreneurship. And I was exposed to it through students of mine who stayed in touch with me, who took me to the Social Innovation Center in Toronto, who exposed me to what they were doing and getting me on their advisory. And I realized that's fascinating. It's something that really wasn't even in the awareness spectrum as I was growing up.
Except that I would say it's very aligned with your values, kind of yeah. your whole approach to the world.
That's right.
But maybe just not labeled as such.
Totally. I mean, it's just a different way of perceiving the way in which you do things. So social enterprise, social entrepreneurship, and started investigating it and took some courses at Wharton online. So again, I was trying to push myself outside my comfort area and learn about it. And then I started applying for fellowships and doing things, always rejected. And that's again where I came up with the understanding that when I was told that it wasn't the right fit, and I looked at the people who were successful, right. they were all 30 years old or younger. Uh-huh. And I got it, but I thought, what a shame mm-hmm. that there wasn't as much talk then, and I'm talking about, 15 years ago about collaboration and intergenerational collaboration, because I think now it's a well-known fact that that is really key moving forward. In any case, to go back to the origin.
You got scared, yeah.
I just decided to go for it. So I had a few people who encouraged me when I talked about the concept of top 60 over 60. Mm-hmm. And as I say, I had intended to focus on that. But after getting into the research, I realized that there were far more important aspects of being older that were important to individuals and to businesses in particular that needed work. And so therefore, I focused more on sort of the ways in which you can collectively influence or take advantage of the older individual's expertise and experience. Yeah, probably one of the most significant things I found out was that experience really trumps knowledge and skill, because those are the things you can learn in one way or another. But experience, you have to live and you have to get to a certain point. It's not to say that it's the only thing that's important, but it's often discredited and disregarded. And we know that it's life experience. It's not always the experience in the work environment that is significant. It's having had children and working at the same time. So helping people understand the value of retaining older employees or rehiring them has really become a focus, and working in the workplace so that those misguided myths about biases against older individuals can be eradicated. And by the same token, there are not equally as many, but there are many myths about millennials and younger generations that are unfavorable in the workplace. And it's, we need to dispel those as well.
Mm-hmm. So, absolutely. I find millennials a really exciting generation.
Yeah, me too.
Very inspiring, actually, to work with.
And they have probably more values in common with boomers than other generations, quite frankly. Mm-hmm. Because when you get to a certain age, you realize that your quality of life and the way in which you live it is really important. And it seems like these millennials have grasped that from the start. And they're not necessarily equating success with being wealthy mm-hmm. or having the biggest house or the most expensive car. Yeah,
right.
Stuff.
Mm-hmm. They want experiences.
Right. And boomers, yeah. I think, unfortunately, perhaps have gone through that phase, come out the other side and realize that that actually isn't all that important. Mm-hmm. What is experiences mm-hmm. in life.
So take us back to the 10-year-old Helen. What was that girl like? Where'd you live? What were you into? How would you describe yourself?
So I grew up, I was a first generation North American in a community next to New York City. Let's put it that way. Mm-hmm. I was born in New York City and raised the first 17 years of my life in the surroundings. So most of my family and everybody lived in the city, and I lived just outside and went to school there. The 10-year-old me wasn't very American at all. I was definitely Eastern European, Czech and Austrian. My parents spoke English very well, but they had an accent. So that always was a distinguishing factor when friends would come over and so on. I was a very skinny kid who was highly competitive, very active. I think I thought I was a boy until I was about 13. I wanted to be I was a tomboy, but that was the only expression you had back mm-hmm. then. So I'm talking now the 50s. Mm-hmm. Girls didn't have any soccer leagues or baseball leagues. I had a brother who was 3 years younger, and he was not very active, athletic, let's put it that way. And I'd sit in the stands and be frustrated that, you know, my brother was out in the field and or couldn't connect the bat with the ball. And there was nothing for me. So I just did whatever I could, which tended to be swimming races, running races, diving. I was really quite proficient at all of those things, skiing, tennis. There was actually not much that I wasn't competitive in. Mm-hmm. So I think that streak, that achievement orientation, I don't have to win anymore and I don't have to be the best. But I know that that was always a motivator for me as a child. And I didn't have that much confidence. So, you know,
being so competitive and winning all the time, you didn't have.
No, and that's one of the learnings, I think, as you get through life, that it doesn't, you know, it comes from within. And you don't necessarily, just because you're successful or you win, feel like you are as good as you probably are perceived on the outside, because it has to do with the messages you get from family. I was brought up also by a generation that never complimented the children, didn't say, oh, that was well done or something. They would always, my mother, in fact, would tell me when I raised our children that they were going to have a swollen head if I kept telling them that they were, they looked nice or that was a great achievement. So there's a lot of that, I think.
A lot of mixed messages. Yeah. Or no messages.
Yeah, no, I don't think they were mixed. Yeah. They loved me dearly. They did the best they could. But I think that their background was different. And it definitely wasn't your typical North American upbringing, that's for sure.
Mm-hmm.
So
what's something you wish you knew earlier in your life or career?
Well, there are a number of things I can honestly say. I think what's important is good energy, being grateful, surrounding yourself with positivity. And I think probably the most significant thing that I've learned is that empathy is probably more important than anything else. And I wish the world were a bit more empathetic. If people could learn empathy, and I do believe that they can, and if there was an emphasis put on that, then I think we'd be living in a better time, in a better place at the moment.
Mm-hmm. We'd be kinder to each other.
Yeah, we'd be kinder to each other. Yeah.
So what about feminism today versus your earlier experiences?
In the generation that I grew up, which would have been the 60s, it really was related more to bra burning and the sexual revolution. And it really focused on that. Sure, equality was significant, but there were no courses on women's literature or anything like that. It was really much more at the elemental level, let's say. Mm-hmm. And I think that fortunately it has progressed and we're now talking about equal numbers of CEOs and board members being women, and that we're much more cognizant of the research around how important women are to the economy, and that we need to, respect women's opinions because they do... they're 50% of the population, if not, and they influence it even more than 50%. So there's a lot more recognition of that. I think, having said that, there's still a long way that we have to go. The fight isn't even nearly over. And I wish I didn't have to even speak of it as a fight. Mm-hmm. But I do believe sometimes that's what it is all about, is helping people understand that the perspective of a woman is very different from a man's. And all the research that's been done in the field of health, which have focused on men, have disadvantaged women, leadership as well. When you're a mother, I know being a father is more today like being a mother than it ever has been. It's much more equal, and thank goodness for that. It is still different. There's still something that's fundamentally very different, and looking out for one's own is fundamental to making the world a better place. So I really do think that there's a lot of work that still needs to be done.
Yeah, and it's kept you active in International Women's Forum.
That's right.
Which I know you've been an active member for a very long time. It's a preeminent global leadership organization for women. There's over 7,000 by invitation only members of women around the world. So why do we still need an organization like IWF?
And we need a lot of places where women can become a community of learners and teachers together. And I think the International Women's Forum is a wonderful opportunity for those who are participating to learn the differences of women globally as well as locally. So there are many different levels. There's the local component, the national, and the international, all of which I think are extremely important to being successful in today's world.
And I love that idea of having this sisterhood, you know, right around the world, that if you land in a city, you can connect with amazing women and have that, as you indicated, that feeling of community wherever you go.
That's right. And I have to say that some of the finest people in my life today are women that I have gotten to know at conferences or meetings of the International Women's Forum. And for that, I'll always be very, very grateful.
Absolutely.
But I know that I can reach out to them as well. And I have, and I've traveled with some of them. And it's made a big difference in my life. So I think there's a real need to continue organizations such as that, where you can confide in somebody else in a safe environment and know that you'll get the best advice possible. Mm-hmm. And it'll help propel you further.
Beautiful. So final question, Helen, what is your dream for Canada?
I've had the good fortune of living in many different countries and traveling around the world. And Canada is truly unique. And I believe it's unique because it is genuine in its welcome of immigrants and refugees to this country. And because of that diversity that we see everywhere, I think this country has a richness that most other countries don't have. You know, as I mentioned, my family were immigrants to the United States. And at that time in the 40s and 50s, they were probably welcomed the way in which Canadians today welcome all refugees and all immigrants. But that's changed. My hope is that that never changes here, because there will always be people seeking a better place to live, and I can't think of a better place to live than Canada.
I couldn't agree more. Thank you, Helen Hirsch-Spence, for sharing your inspiring dream for Canada and for joining me here today on the Fearless Women podcast. Helen Hirsch-Spence is the founder and the big thinker behind Top 60 Over 60. Thanks for listening. We want our community to grow. Tell your friends, follow us on Instagram, and sign up for our newsletter at fearlesswomenpodcast.com to get the early scoop. Subscribe in Apple Podcasts or in your favorite app. And if you like what you hear, give us a 5-star rating. I'm Janice McDonald. Stay fearless. Thank you to the 30% Club Canada for your support of the Fearless Women Podcast. The 30% Club believes that gender balance on boards and in senior management not only encourages better leadership and governance, but diversity further contributes to better all-around board performance and ultimately increased corporate performance for both companies and their shareholders. Want to learn more? Visit their website, 30%club.org, and select the Canada chapter to find out about membership, supporters, and key resources. Thank you to BDC, the bank devoted exclusively to entrepreneurs, for your support of the Fearless Women podcast. We love smart companies that want to amplify women's voices. For more information, go to bdc.ca/women.